Being Programmed to Chill, a show about business, crime, parapolitics, and esoterica, with your host, Jimmy Fallon Gong.
This is Premium Episode 19, Emmanuel Velikovsky, Heresy, Freud, Catastrophism, Spies, Psychological Operations, and the Occult. Today I'm recording from the Ikahulu Chasm on Venus. Shout out yet again to Jonathan's question from our Q&A episodes about history's false narratives. He helped me get onto the Velikovsky beat in the first place, which has in some ways, I wouldn't say consumed my life, but I have spent so much more time thinking about Velikovsky than I ever thought I would. Some of you may remember Premium Episode 17, I was particularly proud of that episode, where we explored a spy ring in the Velikovskian New Chronology Group in Germany and Switzerland. Today I would like to discuss Emmanuel Velikovsky himself, his theories, and his disciples, his network. Now, you don't need to go back and listen to Premium Episode 17. I mean, I do recommend it, it's a great episode. If anything, it might almost make more sense to listen to this one first, but either way, I think it'll be interesting. I don't think you need to necessarily go in order or vice versa, but let's get into the life of Emmanuel Velikovsky. Velikovsky was born in Vitebsk, Russia, which is now in modern-day Belarus. Vitebsk was part of the Pale of Settlement, which was a region that Jews were confined to live in under the Russian Empire. Around 1901, due to reforms in the Russian Empire, the family was able to move to Moscow. Velikovsky's family were well-to-do Jewish intellectuals, and this, of course, heavily shaped his outlook. Through his family, he received a heavy emphasis on Zionism and viewing history through a Jewish lens. The family was also pretty, well-to-do. Velikovsky's father actually shared that enthusiasm for Zionism, and he was actually a delegate to the Second Zionist Congress held in Basel, Switzerland. And while he was there, he actually met Theodor Herzl. Emmanuel Velikovsky described the intellectual milieu of the time, saying, "One is under the influence of the spirit of the time, the dream of Herzl, the intuitions of Freud, and the rays of Roentgen in 1895 were the earthly constellations which marked the direction in which I was to wander. Ideas, like men, need time to grow and find their place in the world." As a child, he was gifted, so he was able to study at a gymnasium in Moscow, where he graduated with honors. When he was 17, this was in 1912, Velikovsky traveled to Palestine for 5 weeks. Velikovsky and his family wanted him to become a doctor, but at that time there were quotas in the Russian education system which limited how many Jews could study at each university. So in 1914, Velikovsky traveled abroad to study in Edinburgh, and he took basically, the older version of pre-med, which allowed him to knock those courses out in order to be able to study at Moscow University, which he did, where he received a medical degree. Due to the Russian Revolution of 1917, or revolutions, his family was uprooted, and they spent several years in Kharkov, now modern-day Ukraine. In 1917, Velikovsky wrote a pamphlet called The Third Exodus, which advocated for Zionism as such. It also argued against the secular socialist elements of the Zionist project in favor of a more religiously motivated Zionism. It's also a very curious pamphlet because it focuses on certain practical elements of emigration to Palestine, and perhaps foreshadowing things to come, Velikovsky made claims that, I guess you could say, he just invented whole cloth, right? Like, he said that venereal disease would be cured if Jews were to emigrate to Palestine. The pamphlet also said that World War I, the Great War as it was called then, was a punishment for Europe's treatment of the Jews. In 1921, Velikovsky and his parents obtained permission to emigrate to Germany. His brothers remained in the Soviet Union, and he would never see them again. Which sounds dramatic, but that was by choice. Around this time, Velikovsky wrote a novella, 30 Days and Nights of Diego Pires, on the Bridge of Sant'Angelo. This novella told the real-life story of a figure from history, a man named Solomon Mulco, who was a Portuguese Moor who converted to Judaism, and then proclaimed a new Messiah, which led him to be burned at the stake for heresy. It was written in these interesting stream-of-consciousness monologues, and supposedly it's not bad. Like, it was praised by Ivan Bunin, the first Russian to win the Nobel Prize for Literature, for example. What's interesting about this, and we'll elaborate, is that Velikovsky continued to be interested in Mulco and other heretics. Velikovsky wrote a piece called Three Fires, which covered three different heretics: Solomon Mulco, Michael Servetus, who was a Spanish theologian and pioneer of anatomy, who was also burned at the stake for heresy, and Giordano Bruno, who we've talked about before. Bruno, of course, was a friar, mathematician, philosopher, and cosmologist whose understanding of the cosmos ended up being quite correct, and Bruno was also a hermetic occultist. Velikovsky was drawn to both literary fiction and heretical science. He was clearly fascinated by both. This would absolutely come up later. Now, you know me. I cannot refrain from fixating on Weimar Germany to save my life. It is probably one of the most interesting places, and I love to read about it. So, when I found out that Velikovsky was in Weimar Germany, why, you couldn't hold me back. So, Velikovsky found himself in Weimar Germany with its rich and decadent culture, right? He wanted to promote Zionism and to make a name for himself as a scholar. So he proposed a pretty interesting proposal, right? Velikovsky proposed the publication of several large volumes of scholarship by a collection of prominent Jewish intellectuals. The idea was to publish this in Hebrew and also publish it in other languages side by side. The idea was that these publications would become the seed for a university in Jerusalem. The publication project would be bankrolled by his father, of course. So they managed to recruit Albert Einstein to be an editor. They also wanted to get Sigmund Freud, but Freud refused, as he had his own journal at that point. And I think this was in the era where he was becoming starting to refuse to publish anywhere but in his own journal, I think is the fair way to say that. Now, Velikovsky's project was to be called the Scripta Universitatis Atque Bibliothecae Hierosolimitarum, and it appeared in 1923. Now, basically, this publication did, in fact, go on to become the seed for Hebrew University. And it pretty much succeeded both in, like, vaunting Jewish science and, becoming that kernel that would become a whole university, right? Velikovsky, however, clearly had ambitions, and later on, when he was much older, he made the claim that Chaim Weizmann, who would become the first president of the State of Israel, asked Velikovsky to be the father of the Hebrew University. Needless to say, there's really no record of this being true. There being no historical record of something being true is also a theme that will pop up again and again in Velikovsky's life. Now, in Weimar Germany, Velikovsky, already being a medical doctor, he studied under Sigmund Freud in Vienna. Velikovsky published in various medical and psychoanalytic journals at this time. He also got married in 1923. From 1924 on, Velikovsky and his parents, I believe, and his wife, they moved to the British Mandate of Palestine. Though Velikovsky was already studying psychoanalysis, his mother died in 1928, and he wrote, In 1928, after the death of my mother, I turned my interest to psychoanalysis. Which is like so hilariously Freudian, like I can't even stand it, right? In 1930, Velikovsky went to Zurich and Geneva, where he studied neurology. He also studied under Eugene Minkowski, and he actually had a split with him over a pretty interesting disagreement. They disagreed over whether there was a connection between physical and psychic phenomena, with Velikovsky being certain there was a link. Now, this is very interesting because Velikovsky was also very interested in spiritualism. By 1933, Velikovsky was fully trained as a psychoanalyst. But he would never be a normal psychoanalyst, and he rarely had like a consistent practice going either. Interestingly, the first major article that he published after being a fully licensed psychoanalyst was about how nervous energy could be transferred. The first major article he wrote as a psychoanalyst was pretty telling. He postulated that nervous energy was a form of like any other type of energy. And just like in physics, how energy, you know, is not wasted, it's transferred, so too could nervous energy be transferred. Therefore, telepathy and psychic energy existed. Now, supposedly, Freud wrote to Velikovsky and said that he agreed with him, and I think that that letter actually exists. Now, at this juncture in his life, like we're talking 1938, Velikovsky was 43, and he realized he was getting old, right? And if he needed to find the topic that he could make his life's major work. And he would find that topic in Freud's last work, Moses and Monotheism, which is also, arguably, Freud's most controversial work. Like, maybe not most controversial, but like, it is one of his most controversial works. Moses and Monotheism argues, more or less ahistorically, that Moses was actually a renegade priest from the Pharaoh Akhenaten's monotheistic sun religion. As Freud postulates, Moses recruited the Hebrew slaves for his cause. Freud also argues that the Hebrews murdered Moses and then chose to revere him. Freud says that the Hebrews repressed their collective guilt, which led them to make neurotic expressions of religious sentiment. It kind of goes without saying that there's really no proof that any of that is true. And so we're basically talking about Freud making shit up and talking about repressed memories, which is very interesting, right? It is a fascinating late Freud piece. Moses and monotheism has been viewed charitably as an imaginative framework, quote-unquote, though it has also been described as totally devoid of serious historical method. That, quote, being from a prominent biblical archaeologist. A prominent Egyptologist said that Moses and monotheism has no basis in historical fact. So why did Freud write it? Freud wrote a book that basically argued that biblical monotheism was simply the result of murder, and that the entirety of Western civilization was therefore a weird interplay between repressed memories and guilt. And Velikovsky saw that and said, "Ah, yeah, that's my shit." Though he wanted to basically do the same thing using the same tactics to argue the exact opposite point, rather than undermining the Jews and, technically, Western civilization, Velikovsky would prop them up with essentially made-up stories. Velikovsky decided to take a leave of absence and go to New York City to write a response. He arrived in Manhattan in 1939, not long after his wife and children would join him, due to the uncertainties of World War II starting, basically. It is also pretty instructive to look at what Velikovsky had been working on before settling into catastrophism. He was writing a book called The Masks of Homosexuality. He was arguing that subconscious homosexuality was behind many neurotic behaviors. He would not finish that work, but in later texts he would write, My view derived at that time from psychoanalytic thinking, which saw in repressed homosexuality of entire nations the source of hatred and lust for doing bodily harm on a mass scale, of the massacres and the triumphs of a race motivated by male homosexuality against and over an effeminate nation. I still believe that suppressed homosexuality has much to do with aggression. Which, I mean, maybe. Maybe not. Considering politics through the lens of sexuality is always interesting, just ask Maxim Gorky. But, as with virtually all psychoanalysis, it's also just a ton of bullshitting. Velikovsky argued that a lot of Arab anti-Semitism was due to latent homosexuality, which strikes me as a very flawed argument. But hey, I'm not the guy who studied under Sigmund Freud, right? What do I know? Quickly, though, Velikovsky narrowed down his focus to essentially just countering Freud's attack on Judaism in his work Moses and Monotheism. In writing a defense of Moses, Velikovsky found a suggestion that the Dead Sea may have been created in a catastrophic event. That got him looking for more biblical events associated by or near astronomical occurrences. He quickly started to suspect that Venus was involved. Velikovsky would work on this text for 10 years, just under 10 years, and it was to be called Worlds in Collision, which would be published in 1950. The basic premise of Worlds in Collision is that Venus was ejected from Jupiter as a type of comet, and that it passed near Earth around the 15th century BC. The idea is that this changed Earth's orbit and axis and caused all kinds of catastrophes which appear in nearly every religion and culture around the world. Towards the end, as it was about to be published, we have the interesting anecdote from two editors who were forced to work with Velikovsky on his footnotes specifically in the process of publishing it. Quote, Velikovsky was infuriated by everything, by our introduction, by our excerpting, by our footnoting. All because we did not present his stuff as unquestioned truth supplanting all previous erroneous theories. He was not only a supreme egomaniac, but he was evangelical about it. He was Muhammad, John the Baptist, and Saint Paul rolled into one. He found the long secret truth and would proclaim it to the world, which should bow down and thank him, but which instead doubted, questioned, and tried to silence him. He was a pretty good paranoiac, too. And in a separate passage, they say, finally he leapt from the table when I was being insistent on one point, and came back with a pistol or revolver which he placed on the table beside him, saying something like, now we'll see how this will be handled. Absolutely psycho shit, right? Now, when you understand the history of Worlds in Collision as fundamentally not a historical work or a work of science or astrophysics, astronomy, none of that, when you realize that it's a reply to Freud's Moses and Monotheism, it makes a lot more sense, because it's essentially one psychoanalyst just making shit up to argue against a different psychoanalyst making shit up. To quote Professor Michael D. Gordon, professor of history at Princeton, Velikovsky approached the world's literary heritage by interpreting their traces as masking hidden trauma. He was no literalist. Gordon quoting Velikovsky, to uncover their vestiges and their distorted equivalents in the physical, later editions psychical, life of peoples is a task not unlike that of overcoming amnesia in a single person, unquote. With an admirable degree of candor, Velikovsky noted in his unpublished memoirs that he now saw how my years of sessions with patients prepared me for my future work by allowing to see similarities in things that do not at first glance seem related. By collecting an earthquake reference here, an account of a dragon in the heavens there, Velikovsky assembled a dream journal for humanity. Unquote. A dream journal for humanity is a good way to put it. Except that he was trying to pass it off as, you know, not metaphorical. Right. Or not, you know, dream logic or something. Now, I believe I may have mentioned this in my past episode about new chronology, but Velikovsky drew inspiration from three previous thinkers, though he initially denied having been familiar with their works at all. Now, how was Velikovsky able to write this book working on it for 10 years? He managed to live off of savings. He managed to live off of the rent from a building in Tel Aviv, which his parents ran, and which he inherited. And he also made money doing illegal psychoanalysis in the United States. I say illegal because he wasn't certified to be practicing in the US, but he was doing it anyway, under the table. After Worlds in Collision was published, the royalties became his primary source of income, and he and his family moved to Princeton in 1952. From then on, Velikovsky would write a series of books which made increasingly astounding claims. For example, he said that the Great Flood of the Bible was actually caused by Saturn exploding. He suggested that the Tower of Babel was destroyed by an electrical discharge from when the planet Mercury flew past the Earth. Naturally, of course, all of these events wiped out the memory of humanity, and, possibly my favorite, Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed by a lightning bolt out of Jupiter. Now, you might be saying to yourself, I'm no big city astronomer, right? But I don't think planets work like that. Well, to support this theory, he basically developed a theory that I guess you could say overturned Newtonian physics. He postulated that gravity was actually an electromagnetic phenomenon. This is one of the sources of the later developed electric universe theory, which there are aspects to that, you know, hold up, but the way Velikovsky was arguing it, almost certainly not how the universe works, right? Velikovsky also argued, again with like no real proof, that King Solomon knew about radium and used it. Despite knowing nothing particularly about weather, Velikovsky was enthusiastic about the possibilities of weather modification, which I found particularly interesting. He was into some really far-out concepts. But the core of his books, the constant, is that humanity had repressed trauma, and that all evidence in favor of that was used for it, and any evidence to the contrary was clearly a subconscious compulsion to deny the great catastrophes of the past. Only true visionaries, like prophets, like Dante, Shakespeare, and Velikovsky, only they could pierce the veil, so to speak, and see through the collective amnesia blinding humanity. Now, as you might expect, Velikovsky's bastardization of science and history just drove scientists and historians absolutely insane, and it pissed them off to no end. I think particularly scientists were much more driven crazy by this, probably because I think there's a few reasons why, but one of the main ones probably is because historians are a little bit closer to the humanities, a little bit more familiar with people chopping up the facts and reinterpreting them. Maybe they're a little bit more comfortable with ambiguity, and, you know, maybe they're less autistic than scientists who tend to view things very... I mean, I'm not trying to be unfair to scientists, but like, a lot of them view things as like more black and white, maybe, than historians, right? Now, later in the 70s, but I'll say it now, a British mathematics instructor, closer to a scientist, right? A British mathematics instructor named Bob Forrest went through every single one of Velikovsky's sources in his books, and he found that many of the sources cited did not say what Velikovsky was asserting. He published an exhaustive review, and he wrote, "As things stand at the moment, collective amnesia simply puts Velikovsky in a heads-I-win, tails-you-lose situation as regarding his cosmic drama. If a piece of evidence fits, it can be claimed as a hit. If a piece of evidence doesn't fit, it can be claimed as a collective amnesiac disguise, and thus denied the status of a miss. such a vetting procedure must surely be regarded with the greatest suspicion, unquote. What's interesting about Velikovsky is he doesn't even necessarily fit the framework of most alternative scientists. He was much more interested in rewriting the history of the Middle East in order to recenter the Jews. Stephen Jay Gould wrote an article on Velikovsky in 1977, where he wrote, "Velikovsky is aware that the laws of Newton's universe, where forces of gravitation rule the motion of large objects, will not allow planets to wander. Thus, he proposes a fundamentally new physics of electromagnetic forces for large bodies. In short, Velikovsky would rebuild the science of celestial mechanics to save the literal accuracy of the ancient legends." The Velikovsky affair raises what is perhaps the most disturbing question about the public impact of science. How is a layman to judge rival claims of supposed experts? Any person with a gift for words can spin a persuasive argument about any subject not in the domain of a reader's personal expertise. Even von Daniken sounds good if you just read Chariots of the Gods. I am in no position to judge the historical arguments of worlds in collision. I know little of celestial mechanics and even less about the history of the Egyptian Middle Kingdom, although I have heard experts howl about Velikovsky's unorthodox chronology. I do not wish to assume that the non-professional must be wrong. Yet when I see how poorly Velikovsky uses the data I am familiar with, then I must entertain doubts about his handling of material unfamiliar to me. But what is a person who knows neither astronomy, Egyptology, nor geology to do, especially when faced with a hypothesis so intrinsically exciting and a tendency shared, I suspect, by all of us to root for the underdog? We know that many fundamental beliefs of modern science grow as heretical speculations advanced by non-professionals, yet history provides a biased filter for our judgment. We sing praises to the unorthodox hero, but for each successful heretic there are 100 forgotten men who chalked prevailing notions and lost. Who among you has ever heard of Eimer, Queneau, Truman, or Lange, the primary supporters of orthogenesis, which is directed evolution, against the Darwinian tide? Still, I will continue to root for heresy preached by the non-professional. Unfortunately, I don't think that Velikovsky will be among the victors in this hardest of all games to win." Unquote. I think that Gould is basically being as charitable as you could possibly be, and even then, it still might be too charitable. Now, all of this is sort of a historical curiosity, right? But like, why talk about this? Why care about it? Why did I spend so much of my life reading like 2.5 books on Velikovsky, at least? The reason why is because Worlds in Collision was a massive bestseller. And just like how Velikovsky used a heads-I-win, tails-you-lose logic, so it was with his detractors. If they ignored him, he would say, "Why, look, the establishment is too afraid to engage with my work." And if they did engage, and consequently viewed it as dross, like as of no value, Velikovsky would say, "Why are they attacking me? I'm not even an expert. You know, what gives? You're picking on me, right?" It's fundamentally the same logic that cults use.
And this is where we are at. At the lowest level. To have to explain ourselves. For what? For what we do, we have to grovel. The only way to defend ourselves is to attack. If we don't do that, we will lose every battle that we are engaged in. We will never dominate our environment the way we should unless we attack.
Now, Professor Gordon, he argues that astronomers in particular attacked Velikovsky vociferously. Other scientists chose to be less aggro, and historians tended to ignore him, perhaps the wiser way to handle it. But astronomers attacked him for a couple reasons, and I wouldn't necessarily say they had a good reason to, but like, it was grounded in the circumstances they were living in, right? Professor Grandin says they were reacting to McCarthyism and the Lysenko affair in the Soviet Union. Basically, astronomers in particular were very afraid of having a Lysenko on their hands. Now, I know a lot of my listeners know who Trofim Lysenko is. It's almost like a meme, I wouldn't say ideology, like a meme scientific belief to have. And there are some terminally online Marxists on Twitter that unironically endorse Lysenkoism, but essentially, Lysenko in the Soviet Union leveraged political influence to push his particular interpretation of certain scientific theories. And arguably, he set Soviet science back in certain fields by like decades and sort of tarnished it in general, right? Now, if Velikovsky would have had the chance, he absolutely would have done this too. Sort of as a side note, I know I compare almost everything to the LaRouche movement, but Velikovsky, and particularly his followers, remind me of the LaRouche movement, like specifically the cult, for a bunch of reasons, not just the cultish behavior and the bullying, but also because they were actually like a weapon aimed right at the back of the head of the scientific community. I will elaborate on this. Velikovsky was militantly anti-communist, and many scientists in this time, we're talking the 1950s, were fellow travelers. Some were communists, some were just pinkos, you know. Some were just, you know, obviously apolitical or just not oppositional to communism. And so Velikovsky developed what I would call a following of incredibly pedantic and obnoxious followers. They would essentially harass Velikovsky's main critics. And not by coincidence, those happened to be, often, left-wing scientists. It got to the point where some scientists didn't want to engage with Velikovsky in any sense, because then they would get these people annoying them. The most common refrain you would hear, you know, from Velikovsky's fans would be that they had simply just not read Worlds in Collision, and if they would just read the book, they would see the errors of their ways. Which, that particular line, is something you hear quite a bit in the astroturfed pundit sphere. Like, I'm thinking like Jordan Peterson and his fans particularly, right? Like, you have to somehow read Jordan Peterson if you want to criticize him, and so on and so forth, right? And it is sort of a trap, because you don't need to read everything in order to have an opinion on it, though obviously, you know, if you don't, then your opinion is naturally limited, right? So Velikovsky and Einstein knew each other, going back to their days in Weimar Germany, right? And then, through just, you know, the shuffle of, emigration and resettlement, they ended up living near each other in Princeton. Velikovsky sent an early draft of Worlds in Collision to Einstein to read back in 1946. Einstein very charitably told him he should rewrite it to be more, like, in line with astronomy. And we have the letter that he wrote saying, "Thus it is evident to every rational physicist that these catastrophes could have nothing to do with the planet Venus, and that also the Earth's direction of rotation toward the ecliptic could never experience any considerable change without the entire Earth's crust being fully destroyed." Unquote. And with that, Einstein politely declined to discuss it further, because Velikovsky wasn't hearing it. Velikovsky would keep sending him his works until 1950, when Einstein told him that he would not read anymore. Velikovsky sent him a copy of Worlds in Collision anyway. Einstein said that Velikovsky had, quote, "the stuff to thoroughly disprove even the table of multiplication with your historical philological methods. Of the applause of the laymen who have a secret grudge against arithmetic, you can be assured." Unquote. Which, first of all, that's hilarious. And second, I really do love the idea that the average man has a secret grudge against arithmetic. I have felt that to be true sometimes. Now, Einstein didn't want to be rude, so he also wrote, "Against such precise knowledge as celestial mechanics comes speculations of the sorts as you put forward, which cannot be considered by one with a knowledge of the subject. Thus, your book must appear to the expert as an attempt to deceive the lay public. I must confess that I myself initially also had this impression. Only subsequently was it clear to me that intentional deception was far from your intention." Unquote. Yes, it sure would be worrisome if Velikovsky were attempting to deceive the lay public. There was tons of correspondence between Einstein and Velikovsky, various developments in their relationship, but fundamentally Einstein thought Velikovsky was crazy. He told half a dozen people that, like, word for word, basically. And Einstein fundamentally didn't think there was anything to be gained by engaging with his ideas. And being perceptive, I think he was also onto something with the book being an attempt to deceive the lay public. I think he's onto something there. Jay Leno voice. Man, you hear about this Einstein guy? He seemed really smart. Entering the 60s, Velikovsky started to fall in with some people interested in fringe and alternative science, like Joseph Banks Ryan, who studied extrasensory perception. He actually had a program going at Duke University, I believe. Ryan had been attacked by the scientific community. Ryan approached Velikovsky in 1963. I think they met and talked things over, but I don't think a lot came out of that. In the 1960s, Velikovsky realized that, you know, what do prophets do? They make prophecies, right? So he focused on making predictions that would vindicate him, as he framed it. And he based this off of observing what Einstein said. Einstein said that, speaking in general, that it was not enough for a new scientific theory to be consistent with the evidence. It must also make predictions of novel phenomenon not foreseen by prior accounts. Velikovsky would basically study famous, impressive predictions of science, and then he would try to reverse engineer them. So he started to come up with some himself. Now, some of these were pretty impressive, actually, though, as you can kind of imagine, if you just sit there and try, you can probably come up with some yourself. Like, also, science fiction authors do this, like, that's literally their job, right? So if you're well informed enough about science, and you sort of know where a field is headed, you can just sort of throw darts and get a few things right. And if you publish claims and then those end up being right, sometimes you can look like a real freaking genius, right? So Velikovsky predicted the emission of radio noise from Jupiter, which turned out to be true. Astrophysicists said of the prediction, quote, "It is not surprising that the occasional near miss should be found in the large number of wild speculations that Dr. Velikovsky has produced, but such a coincidence could never be regarded as a true prediction." Unquote. Now, Venus, of course, was the key element of Worlds in Collision, not Jupiter, so Velikovsky's predictions mainly focused on Venus. He proposed three crucial tests about Venus. He said that, were these to be true, they would completely vindicate him. The first was that Venus must be very hot. The second, that Venus must be wrapped in hydrocarbon gases and dusts. And third, that the motion of Venus would indicate that it had been disrupted by collisions like retrograde rotation. So the first and the third ended up being true. So did the second, actually. I think the second about hydrocarbons was the last one. So hydrocarbons on Venus became a very important piece of evidence for Velikovsky's theories, right? Now, if you happened to have listened to Premium Episode 17 about the new chronology stuff, you'll recall that the Soviets landed the Venera 9 probe on Venus in 1975, and Velikovsky's stands viewed this as a huge vindication of his work, though most scientists did not agree. Let's talk a little bit more about Velikovsky's followers. We already talked about Christoph Marx and the Society for the Reconstruction of Human and Natural History in episode 17. Now, Velikovsky's inner circle, the disciples, there were roughly 10 of them, they were almost apostolic. One of them wrote, "Yet there is a distinctly Freudian aroma in the air, where the sons appear to be hoping against hope that the father image will die, pass away into oblivion so that the scions can pillage the inheritance and squander the spoils." Unquote. And yeah, all of them appeared to have their own theories waiting in the wings, right? Also, in Premium Episode 17, we talked about Alfred de Grazia at great length. I think I made a pretty convincing case that de Grazia was a spook. Like, it's not hard to see, you can read it in his Wikipedia page. He was literally a spy, right? And he says it over and over again. But to focus in on his actual friendship with Velikovsky, they met when de Grazia was a professor of government and social theory at NYU. De Grazia had read one of Velikovsky's works in 1960 and sought him out, and they became friends. Though the friendship sounds a little bit stilted, like how sometimes if you know a friend who's really on one all the time, that sounds like that's what it would have been like to be Velikovsky's friend. Now, Velikovsky rarely allowed his followers to develop intellectual differences of opinion or alternate theories that did not conform with his own. De Grazia was one of the few that Velikovsky would tolerate to have some degree of difference with him. Like I mentioned in that episode, de Grazia ran a journal, The American Behavioral Scientist. He dedicated an entire issue to Velikovsky, his ideas, and especially his reception by the scientific community. De Grazia claimed to study the Velikovsky affair from a sociological angle, and he got the whole affair going again, like he kicked off a new wave of arguing about Velikovsky. De Grazia would end up publishing the issue as a standalone book, The Velikovsky Affair. In many ways, also, de Grazia helped push Velikovsky's ideas back into the cultural, you know, back into the zeitgeist, and Velikovsky became more popular in the 1970s than in the 1950s. It became very hip to be into Velikovsky, and it was entirely related to the counterculture. And if you think about it, it is not all that different from, like, the Jack Sarfati type of shit, honestly. There's a long list of countercultural, like, crossovers with Velikovsky. For instance, Peter Fonda mentioned Velikovsky in an interview. Stuart Brand was into him. I think that Velikovsky's stuff was sold in the Whole Earth catalog. I'm not certain about that. I think I saw that. And in the 1970s, Velikovsky switched from trying to recruit scientists to trying to recruit young people. He went on speaking engagements all across the country. He would speak at every college that would have him, and sometimes even high schools. Now, there's this book, The Making of a Counterculture, published in 1969 by Theodore Roszak. He said about Velikovsky and his followers, "It is as if many Velikovskyites are saying, science isn't so great, look at all the things it can't explain. Many Velikovskyites, like many others who have no experience in research, betray a basic hostility to science per se." Unquote. Take note here, dear listeners, in 1972, NASA brought Velikovsky to speak several different times. It would appear that Velikovsky was being instrumentalized yet again. In 1974, one enthusiast equated Velikovsky with the New Age directly, saying, "The veil of amnesia has been lifted. The result is the awakening of consciousness. Whether the apocalyptic agent is perceived to be an extraterrestrial jostling, or biospheric poisoning, atomic weaponry overkill, or overpopulation, or whether one has experienced the disintegration of the worldview by chemical inducement, a magical mushroom, or the fabled LSD. The generation of the whole Earth catalog has experienced the catastrophe, and consistent with the amnesia theory, they no longer itch to reenact the primordial paroxysm that heralded our present age. The bomb has gone off." Unquote. The New School for Social Research in New York City started teaching a course on worlds in collision. Several other universities would also teach it. Vine Deloria Jr. got into Velikovsky, Deloria of course being a Native American scholar. Eric von Daniken, who wrote Chariots of the Gods, think ancient aliens guy, right? Not the guy on the History Channel with the hair, but, you know, the guy who originally came up with those ideas, more or less. Von Daniken was basically using a Velikovsky approach, and he applied it to a completely different hypothesis, ancient aliens. And, like, it isn't just a matter of copying the reading into ancient myths to suit your needs concept that he's copying. He also hypothesized that aliens could have been prompted to visit Earth precisely because of some ancient catastrophe. And he specifically cites the Velikovsky and Venus type incident. And what's more, Velikovsky himself was like, "Oh yeah, Nephilim are definitely aliens." So like, there is definitely some like real fellow freak crossover between the two. In fact, the Velikovsky affair impacted how the archaeological scientific community handled von Daniken, because they specifically saw what happened with Velikovsky and didn't want to push the counterculture even further into von Daniken territory by attacking him outright. Now, I don't know if that's the right play either. I mean, ancient aliens was probably going to happen no matter what, right? Especially considering who owns the History Channel, wink. But one of Velikovsky's inner circle, David Talbot, went on to make his own little fiefdom. He would write several books, like The Saturn Myth, ding ding ding, as well as Thunderbolts of the Gods and The Electric Universe. In 1974, Carl Sagan and Emanuel Velikovsky faced off in academic debate. Think of it like a pro wrestling match. Wouldn't that be cool? Giving him the chair. As you might expect, Velikovsky acted like a weirdo. He refused to call his worldview a theory. He said, "My work is first a reconstruction, not a theory. It is built upon studying the human testimony as preserved in the heritage of all ancient civilizations. All these civilizations in texts bequeathed, beginning with the time man learned to write, tell in various forms the very same narrative that the trained eye of a psychoanalyst could not but recognize as so many variants of the same theme." And of course he went on and on making his presentation, but he finished saying, "None of my critics can erase the magnetosphere, nobody can stop the noises of Jupiter, nobody can cool off Venus, and nobody can change a single sentence in my books." Sagan wrote quite a bit about Velikovsky. In all fairness, Sagan did admit that most of Velikovsky's critics did not read him closely or at all. Imagine the Chad meme, right? Not reading Velikovsky. Sagan said if they had read him, they would not have changed their minds. If you're curious to read a layman's debunking of Velikovsky, by that I mean a debunking oriented towards like a layman reading it, check out Sagan's essay, Venus and Dr. Velikovsky, in his book, Broca's Brain. Now here's where we enter in more fully into weird op territory. In the 70s, the CBC produced a Velikovsky documentary in 1972. The BBC produced one the same year. Interestingly, Philip Glass, who I'm a big fan of, he actually intended to write an opera about Velikovsky's book, Oedipus and Akhenaten, which he ended up just making it about Akhenaten, and there were no Velikovskian elements other than some residual Oedipal motifs. You know who else was a fan and personal friend of Emmanuel Velikovsky? New York Times columnist William Safire, who he said he was a fan of both Velikovsky's scientific and geopolitical claims. Real cool. Velikovsky died in 1979. Upon his death, Alfred de Gracia began publishing his own Velikovskian theories, which he called quantavolution. Quantavolution. He also used the term revolutionary primeveology. Primeveology. And he was doing essentially the same thing, harvesting ancient myths and legends to argue for a completely different conception of astronomy, though de Gracia's theories differed from Velikovsky's in specifics. I mentioned, of course, before David Talbot also came out with his electric universe theory, going off of Velikovsky, fundamentally trying to just swap out conventional physics with its gravitation and nuclear forces and replacing it with plasma and electricity instead. Yes, also kind of playing into the whole ether thing from like the 19th century. Interesting stuff, right? Now, according to Professor Gordon, if we were to truly take Velikovsky seriously, then we would have to issue a mass reformulation of geology, paleontology, archaeology, and celestial mechanics, not to mention ancient history, including chronology. The whole reason why Velikovsky, my words here, the whole reason why Velikovsky got into new chronology is to make his own dumbass theory fit. I think he specifically had like a 600-year gap where things didn't work unless he basically postulated lost time, right? Professor Gordon talked about how the demarcation problem, and by that I mean what is science, what is pseudoscience, the demarcation problem is actually not very well fleshed out, and that pseudoscience, much like pornography, is something that anyone can recognize but no one can actually define. He speaks on this at great length. I found his arguments very compelling, or his passages very compelling, but I am not primarily interested in the history of science. So if you are, I would recommend checking out his book, The Pseudoscience Wars, if you want to read about that. I think I mentioned in Premium Episode 17, but there was also a whole very interesting interplay between the transition from like older versions of science and creationism, like modern creationism. Velikovsky was like a stepping stone to modern creationism. Really interesting stuff. What's interesting to me, however, is the symbolism involved in selecting Venus, of all things, as your central focal point. Like, if you're making shit up, why pick Venus, you know? I mean, you could just as well pick anything else, but Venus is the goddess of rebirth and destruction. Velikovsky would always overtly make links between Athena and Venus, and he framed much of mythology as the struggle between Venus and Mars, linking it to Athena and Ares fighting in the Iliad, for example. He would also link it to the book of Isaiah in the Bible. Venus has a rich body of magical astrological associations that you can take in many directions. Very curious indeed.
Kisses and my arms, a girl with all the charms of you. Venus, make her fair, a lovely girl with sunlight in her hair. And take the brightest stars up in the skies and place them in her eyes for me. As long as we both shall live. Venus, goddess of love that you are, surely the things I ask can't be too great a task. Venus, if you do, I promise that I always will be true. Give her all the love I have to give, as long as we both shall live.
Also, you want to get a little bit nutty? In Premium Episode 17, where I briefly covered Velikovsky's life, I discussed how his book got immediate, favorable, widespread reviews from publishers, while scientists were basically baffled and confused and then angered by it. And they were especially angered by all the good press it was getting. To cite a few, there were favorable reviews from Harper's Magazine and Reader's Digest, which were, of course, real heavy hitters back then. My contention was that that doesn't just happen by accident. Something didn't add up, and what's worse, according to the scientists, Worlds in Collision was published by Macmillan, the publishing company, which was at that time one of the most distinguished publishers of textbooks and scientific research. Incidentally, and entirely coincidentally, I'm sure, it's a British-owned company. Macmillan bumped Worlds in Collision over to Doubleday, one of their, you know, other companies, in order to appease the scientific community. Other than Einstein, one professor of astronomy, Dean McLaughlin, got close to what I suspect is the truth when he wrote, "In the case of the Velikovsky book, the author is no more to be blamed than the insane are to be blamed for their acts or their delusions. He is a deluded man. It is the Macmillan Company that is guilty, either through intent or negligence, of an irresponsible act towards society. Their responsibility was perfectly clear." Professor McLaughlin asserted that there was no peer review, for how could this drivel have survived? He continued writing, "Seriously wondering which of the two hypotheses is nearest to the truth. Has the Macmillan Company been sold a bill of goods by a quack? Or did they, knowing the author's claims to be absurd, recognize material for a bestseller? On the one hypothesis, they are dupes and gulls. On the other, they are deliberate partners in a fraud, a deliberate conspiracy to misinform the public." Unquote. Now, I would disagree with the good professor. I'm not sure that the motivation was simply to have a bestseller. I'm certain that factored in. But I do agree with his framing. What is more likely? Do you think McMillan was completely duped and fooled, or do you think that they are partners in a fraud to misinform the public as part of a deliberate conspiracy? What's that? What did Einstein say? Einstein said, "Your book must appear to the expert as an attempt to deceive the lay public." Given that Velikovsky had speaking engagements across the country, he had a weird cult-like group that would do tactics of harassment. There's also the would-be geopolitical implications of his theories, to say nothing of the occulted ones. I feel pretty comfortable asserting that it was a deliberate fraud, a deliberate conspiracy to misinform the public. You add Alfred de Grazia into the mix, and you start to head more and more into psychological warfare territory. What's that? Alfred de Grazia was actually a psychological warfare officer? Oh, okay then. There's one more piece of evidence to support this idea. Who am I kidding? There's several more, but let's talk about one. Back in the 1950s, there were two individuals who lost their jobs over supporting Velikovsky and his ideas. Let's look at both of them. The first was the editor, the head editor of Worlds in Collision. Not one of the two editors bitching about how annoying he was and how he threatened them with a gun. This editor was named James Putnam, and in the fracas that ensued after publication, he was the one who took the brunt of the criticism for allowing the book to be published without really any kind of peer review. And it was Putnam who chose to go ahead and publish it. He's the fall guy, I guess you could say. And he also had on-the-record warnings about the need to have its claims evaluated, and he got caught ignoring them, right? It's always a bureaucratic shit show, and whoever is the fall guy often isn't the most to blame, but by no means was he innocent, so we shouldn't cry for him, right? Either way, curious behavior, right? Ignoring these on-the-record warnings about how this book is basically fiction, and he just ignores it. Now, he got fired from Macmillan, but he got a fatty severance package, and he soon got a plum job at the trade department of the World Publishing Company. Later on, he got another plum job as general secretary of the Penn World Association of Writers. By the way, the World Publishing Company was the leading publisher of Bibles. They also published Robert Ludlum, Ayn Rand, Gay Talese, and Ling Yungtang, to get a feel for what they were about. The other guy who lost his job was Gordon Atwater, who was a planetarium director. He also was a fact-checker and blurb writer for the original edition of Worlds in Collision. He also planned a crossover event at his planetarium for Velikovsky to present his ideas to the public. Atwater ended up beefing with the directors of his planetarium, who told him to cut it out with all the Velikovsky stuff. He eventually got fired over it. And Atwater would lament at how he was railroaded out of the scientific community and could never get another job again. Except, Atwater wasn't really in the scientific community in the first place. He was in the Navy, and he taught navigational courses to sailors during World War II. He got his planetarium job off of his work experience. He was not an astronomer or a trained scientist of any kind. Pretty curious, huh? A former naval officer carrying water for this weird psyop. Interesting. Let's get even nuttier. So it is pretty well documented that David Ahrens, one of the executives for the Gimbel Brothers department store chain, was a huge Velikovsky fan. He would promote his works every chance he got. What's weirder, though, is that Ahrens had a son who was a NASA attorney who had discussed how unfairly Velikovsky was being treated by the scientific community. This NASA attorney was discussing how unfairly Velikovsky was being treated with Dr. Homer E. Newell Jr., the head of NASA. You remember I mentioned earlier that NASA had Velikovsky come speak several times, right? I wonder if NASA had any interest in psychological operations being run on the public. that sure would be interesting to consider. Now, if you can believe it, dear listeners, I actually subjected myself to yet another Alfred de Grazia book, Cosmic Heretics, a personal history of attempts to establish and resist theories of quantum evolution, and catastrophe in the natural and human sciences. The book is insane. I actually thought it would be way more relevant to this episode, but it actually weirdly wasn't. I also did want to comment on de Grazia's prose. It's very hard to read him, and, like, you know me, dear listener, like, I've read Marx, I've read, God help me, I've read Hegel, I've read a ton of philosophy, you know, postmodern literature, modernist literature. Like, I'm used to very difficult, obtuse, even sometimes asinine prose, right? I'm used to reading now a lot of history. Like, I'm used to intentionally obfuscatory stuff, right? But de Grazia, like, will take the most straightforward sentence and he will loop the sentence. He'll, like, tie his shoes with it. He will, like, loop subjunctive clauses and, like, weave together various independent and dependent clauses. And it basically makes you stop and have to, like, parse what's being said. And, like, I only really have seen it in, like, Hegel or something, except, like, you know, with that, it's almost on, you know, it almost has to be that way. And with de Grazia, he'll just be, like, telling a normal-ass story. Like, it's almost like a thing that, like, bad writers do on accident, but he's, like, you can tell that he's doing it on purpose as some sort of, like, weird psyop or something. It's hard to explain. Anyway, what's really interesting about de Grazia's book, where he talks about Velikovsky, his relationship to him, Velikovsky's ideas and de Grazia's ideas, he doesn't take the sucker position, and he doesn't insist that Velikovsky was correct about his theories. No, he pretty much says outright that Velikovsky is kind of like, the term didn't exist yet, but like, Velikovsky is doing almost like social justice warrior type behaviors. I'll explain what he means by quoting him. Quote, "Nonetheless, the exposition of such large ideas and the controversy over them would perform the first major task of any revolution, namely the refocusing of attention and the conditioning of the minds of scientists and teachers to the new frame of thought. In these very days of the 1960s, the leaders of the movement for women's liberation were stressing consciousness raising. Many blacks were doing the same by stressing negritude, as the French blacks called it, and accusing pro-black liberal whites, their best friends, quote-unquote, of necessarily being racially prejudiced. Radical students also caught on to the effectiveness of irrational, often destructive behavior as a way of getting the attention of the civil and educational authorities," unquote. Like, de Grazia is saying that Velikovsky is not right or wrong about his theories. He's saying that this is a tactic. It's fundamentally, like, throwing a fit, almost like a child does, refocusing and conditioning an audience to be centered around the needs of a particular audience. Obviously, de Grazia is being kind of paternalistic about comparing it to feminism and, you know, black studies. But I don't think he's wrong in that. In the 60s and 70s, a lot of their literature was focused around, you know, raising, you know, a ruckus. Like, pointing out, hey, rape culture exists. Hey, like, people are still getting lynched, you know, this or that. And, like, that consciousness raising, that recentering blackness or the female experience served a tactical purpose. And essentially, Velikovsky is doing the same exact thing, except that he is refocusing on Israel. De Grazia calls it a psychoanalytic weapon, which Velikovsky got from Freud. And of course, Freud used. Velikovsky used this against Freud, but then later in the service of Israel. Side note, in reading about Velikovsky and his followers, separate from the whole intelligence angle and the whole cult-like angle and like just bullying people, separate from that part. Just the proselyting your ideas thing, it really reminds me of being a Mormon missionary in that absolutely nobody wanted to talk to you because you're being annoying. Real flashbacks, right? Now let's talk about Velikovsky's disciples, as in other than Alfred de Grazia and Christoph Marx. Good time to plug yet again my episode 17, where we learned that Christoph Marx was a spy for the Soviets, and or dot dot dot. No, instead, let's talk about the Society for Interdisciplinary Studies, SIS. I promised we would talk about them. So the society formed as four members were sitting around on Halloween 1973 discussing Velikovsky. Boy, what a good Halloween party, right? Out of those talks, they then met on November 5th, 1974. Notice the date? That's Guy Fawkes Day. I mean, whomst among us has not started a heretical scientific study group on All Hallows Eve, and then also on Guy Fawkes Day, right? And if you think that, you know, that's a coincidence, no, it's absolutely not. It's not a coincidence that it's SIS. It's not a coincidence that it was Halloween and Guy Fawkes Day. De Grazia said that they formed by a gang of four, Ewan W. McKee, Harold Tressman, Brian Moore, and Martin Seif. When they founded SIS, I believe a lot of them were still students or had recently graduated. Other prominent members would include Malcolm Lowry, Peter James, Ralph Amelon, Jeffrey Gammon, John J. Bimson, Eric Crew, Chaim McCobe, Michael Reed, Bernard Newgrosh, and Bernard Prescott. Almost none of the Brits or Scots ever met Velikovsky, while the American contributors had. Let's go through just a couple of these. Just a couple of these guys. Dr. Ewan W. McKee, he later became a professor of archaeology and anthropology at the University of Glasgow. He pioneered the field of archaeoastronomy. Harold Tressman was a London businessman, or he became a London businessman, and apart from helping found the SIS, he also helped develop the Saturn theory, which, you know, Saturnine currents, man. Saturn plays a prominent role in some pretty dark magical systems. You know, I touched on it in my episode on Gnosticism. Also, Recluse has done some really interesting Saturn episodes over on the farm. There's a lot there with Saturn. But Tressman worked on the Saturn theory with David Talbot, who I've mentioned several times, who wrote the Saturn myth. Brian Moore was a librarian. Martin Seif was probably the most interesting of the Gang of Four. He's from Belfast. He's Anglo-Irish-Jewish, a journalist and a historian. He studied at Oxford and the London School of Economics. He went on to be a defense industry editor for United Press International. United Press International has an interesting history because it has roots in the Hearst publishing empire. United Press International was later bought by the Moonies in 2000. Seif was actually the chief political correspondent for UPI when the Moonies acquired it, which is something interesting to think about. Seif's area of study is modern U.S. history, including the very charming book, I'm sure, called The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Middle East. He became a talking head and would appear on literally every channel you could think of, and he wrote for almost every publication you can think of. He was also closely associated with, I think maybe even helped found, the Global Policy Institute, which is a think tank. As I was looking through their website, I noticed the timely article, "Whether Russia invades or not, Biden has handled the Ukraine crisis well," which apparently appeared also in Forbes magazine. Note, the article was written before the Russian invasion, just a couple weeks before, which is just chef's kiss. Either way, I have a general rule of never trying to mess with or even contact people who are still alive, and I generally don't even always like to talk about people who are living. And basically it's because I don't want any smoke from anyone for anything. And the few times that I've broken that rule, it's almost always caused problems for me. Regardless, because I love you, dear listener, I broke that rule for this episode. I reached out to Martin Seif. I asked him for a comment. I will read out what I wrote, excluding the introduction. I was researching the Society for Interdisciplinary Studies and its founders, and found Peter James on a list of MI6 agents, although I could not prove that it was the same person. Further, Chaim Mekobi served in signals intelligence. You and Ralph Amelon were both associated with the Global Policy Institute. And, of course, Alfred DeGrazia was a spy. I found other, less clear connections. I wanted to get your comment about whether the Society for Interdisciplinary Studies, SIS, was an arm of British intelligence in any sense. Unquote. Unfortunately, he did not respond for comment. However, the email gets me to my next point. Like I said, I was searching through the backgrounds of these various members. These members of SIS, I found Peter James on a list of MI6 agents. Jeffrey Gammon held a, quote, senior position in the civil service, which is not conclusive, but it does not sound like a possible cover either. Chaim Mekobi served in signals intelligence during World War II. And like I said, Martin Seif and Ralph Amelon are both associated with the Global Policy Institute. Was SIS an arm of British intelligence? Was it an asset organization in some way? A front? I mean, Lord knows Christoph Marx. You know. Spy for the Soviets? Why wouldn't the SIS have at least one spy, right? Much less several. I also found smoke but not fire for a number of other members, right? If the purpose of Velikovsky's theories is, as I suspect it is, to refocus and recenter Israel and to salvage biblical texts from science, then there would be a definite purpose for that intelligence could use. And if there's a potential magical undercurrent, which I think you can genuinely also argue, given the Halloween and Guy Fawkes Day bullshit, and given that the whole thing is basically inventing a story about Venus with no evidence, then I think there's something really strange going on. In my previous episode, episode 17, about new chronology, I talked about how, among other things, new chronology is a good psychological operation because even engaging with it is an exhausting waste of time. There's the mindfuck element involved in just having to swallow such a crazy story in the first place, which opens you up to being into other crazy ideas. Like, you see this with Flat Earth, Hollow Earth, UFOs, many cults, theosophy, magic. But separate, but entirely related, if you view these theories from an occult perspective, then you really have something to chew on. I have a lot of friends and family. Nobody I've ever met has ever said that they were familiar with Velikovsky in any sense. Even all of my wonderful internet friends, not very familiar with Velikovsky. There was just one person, a person on the Subliminal Jihad Discord, with the username Buttercup Joe. Buttercup Joe is familiar with Velikovsky, so I asked Buttercup Joe what he thought of Velikovsky. And we discussed it, you know, back and forth for a little bit, but he said something very insightful, I think. He said, quote, from an occult perspective, there's a lot to draw from Velikovsky's work. By that I mean, if you're looking to understand Saturn, for instance, and its significance in, say, the Typhonian magic system, or David Talbot's Saturnine writings, or Thelema, then Velikovsky's work has a lot to say. I think you can especially draw from Oedipus and Akhenaten, one of my favorite of Velikovsky's books. Unquote. There is a magical undercurrent to this catastrophism stuff. The purpose for it is not entirely clear to me. But Velikovsky's interest in heretics is another tip-off that this is fundamentally not about science, it's about esoteric beliefs. And the blatant disregard and even abuse of science, well, Velikovsky got that from Freud. For what it's worth, there's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. And in the words of Buffalo Springfield, paranoia strikes deep. Into your lives, it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, and the men come and take you away. For sources today, I used the excellent book, The Pseudoscience Wars, Emmanuel Velikovsky and the Birth of the Modern Fringe. I also used the book Cosmic Heretics. I don't have the rest of the title, it's too freaking long. DeGrazia has the longest book titles, I swear. I also used Carl Sagan's book, Broca's Brain, as well as an article by Stephen Jay Gould entitled Velikovsky in Collision. That's right, dear listeners, I read, 2.5 books worth of content on Velikovsky. Good Lord. Thank you for listening, dear listener. Thank you for subscribing. I appreciate it. You are already on the Patreon side, so just tell a friend about the show. And I know many of you have. I hear all the time from people that they've been recommended the show. And I know that word of mouth is really, you know, what's getting my show across, because I'll be honest with you, I don't think I'm ever getting any kind of deals or promotion or anything. Like, it's pretty much strictly independent, right? So you should feel good about supporting independent creators, right? Either way, at least know that I appreciate it. See you next episode, and God bless.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. There's battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. What a field day for the heat. Thousand people in the street singing songs and carrying signs, mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. Your life, it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. We better stop now.